This week, on Behind the Lens, the federal government approves a major disaster declaration for Louisiana. We're a hotspot for the COVID-19 crisis. Are those resources enough to manage here? We'll hear from the governor. We'll get fresh analysis from Russell Honoray, the former military commander and crisis analyst, has choice words for the feds at this point. We'll also hear from the Lens reporting staff, and we'll check in with the restaurant industry, a critical sector at a critical time. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by community support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. And we welcome our listeners online on podcast app and on our community radio partners, 102.3 FM in Mid-City, WHIV LP New Orleans, and 90.3 FM in the Marigny, WAMF LP New Orleans. There are calls at the highest levels of American government to ease social distancing measures and commercial shutdowns that have crippled the economy. But in New Orleans and other hotspots nationwide, there's not much sign of an easing in the COVID-19 outbreak. The number of confirmed cases in New Orleans alone exceeded 1,100 people by Friday, with 2,700 in the entire state. The death toll was closing in on 120 souls, almost half of them in New Orleans. Governor John Bel Edwards has continued a series of nearly daily briefings on the pandemic. Here's part of his news conference Friday afternoon.
We are pleased to learn this morning that Congress has passed the $2.3 trillion relief bill that will mean help for many people and businesses across the country and here in Louisiana. We anticipate that the president will sign that bill into law today. There will be major resources for hospitals, including funding for grants to cover unreimbursed health care expenses and increased access to digital health care delivery. There's going to be direct checks for families. In addition, there will be small business loans to cover daily operations, including payroll and rent to keep the doors open. Expanded unemployment benefits and training dollars for dislocated workers are included as well. We know that there's additional assistance for food banks and SNAP benefits to help our most vulnerable citizens. There also will be additional funding for child nutrition programs to make sure that our children still receive meals while they're not attending school. Rest assured that all of our state agencies are combing through the bill to make sure that we identify every bit of funding and assistance, flexibility, that we can take advantage of. But let me just say we're very grateful to our congressional delegation for the work that they did in helping to get this important bill passed. As I just mentioned, we're in the process of studying what the bill contains for Louisiana, but we do know that Louisiana is estimated to get $1.8 billion in direct federal aid from the federal government. We've also been led to believe that that funding could be available to us in as little as 30 days. Obviously, that will be very helpful. We are one day deeper into this event, and while we don't know what the duration will be, we do know that we are doing everything within our power to respond to this crisis, and we need everyone. I implore everyone to do their part as well. And that means staying home, minimizing your travel, minimizing your social contact. The numbers that we report to you every day should underscore why slowing the spread of this virus is so important. And as of noon today, Louisiana has reported 2,746 cases of COVID-19. Now that is 441 cases more than yesterday. That is a 19% increase in the last 24 hours. Now, there's some good news and some not so good news. It's a lower number from yesterday's increase of 510, and yesterday's growth was 28%, and today's was 19. But I want you all to keep in mind, today's increase was only from half as many tests. So it's a mixed bag, and we are trying to figure out what it means. And there's a lot of information that you have to know, much of which I don't think we actually have right now. But I've asked my team, including Dr. Biu, to make sure that we're analyzing these numbers so we can glean as quickly as possible what the trends are. But I can tell you, as of far as what we know, we still remain on the growth curve, that the trajectory that we don't like, the one that we need to flatten just as soon as possible. The other news that really there's no way to spin it or misinterpret it, we now have 119 deaths. That's an increase of 36 deaths since our last update. This is the largest increase in deaths yet to be reported on a daily basis. Yesterday we had 18 deaths. You will also see, if you look at the video monitor here, that New Orleans has surpassed 1,000 cases. I'd also point out that we now have 200 cases in the four most northwestern parishes. And I point that out just so that everyone understands that this is, in fact, spread all across the state of Louisiana. We have cases in all but nine of our 64 parishes now. And nobody should think that they don't have the virus, the novel coronavirus, or that they don't have COVID-19 in their parishes. I can assure you it's in every parish, in every community across the state of Louisiana. Getting back to the deaths that we have reported, up to now 119 of them, early analysis indicates that conditions among those COVID-19 deaths include diabetes, 41%, kidney disease, 31%, and obesity, 28%. Louisiana is third in the nation per capita for the number of cases. We are second, I believe, per capita in the number of deaths. Obviously, this is a public health emergency, as it has been described, and it shows no signs yet of abating. And I want to encourage everyone to take this extremely seriously. You've heard me say it before, but medical surge is our number one priority in terms of what we as a state are doing. The number one priority in terms of what I'm asking the citizens of our state to do is to minimize the spread by practicing the mitigation measures that we put in place, the social distancing, the stay-at-home order, and so forth. But on the medical surge part of this, we remain on the trend line that we've been on for a few days. And that is under current modeling that we would run out of ventilators sometime around April the 2nd or 3rd in Region 1 down around New Orleans for those patients who need ventilators. Just to put into context to people how hard it is to acquire new ventilators, we have put in many days ago orders for 12,000 ventilators, I think 5,000 of those from the Strategic National Stockpile, the remainder from private vendors and manufacturers, and to date we have received exactly 192. Those 192 ventilators have all been allocated and delivered. We do expect a shipment of another 100 early next week, but we need several thousand ventilators. We're going to keep working on this, obviously. And I would remind everybody that when we overwhelm our capacity, our hospital's capacity to deliver care, it doesn't just threaten COVID-19 patients. It threatens everybody who might need emergency or intensive care at a hospital. Whether you're a motor vehicle accident, a heart attack victim, or a stroke victim, or whatever. And so I'm asking everyone to do what they can to be a good neighbor, to lower the number of cases that we are announcing every day, start to flatten that curve, incredibly important.
That's Governor Edwards speaking late Friday. Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, Army retired, has been watching the governor and federal authorities very closely now. He spoke with us Friday morning on the latest developments. First thing I want to ask you about is a report that came out this week that the Environmental Protection Agency will suspend enforcement of environmental laws, citing the pandemic, making it difficult for companies to comply with public health and environmental laws. Do you have any response to that in your capacity as a leader of Green Army?
Yeah, I think that's an unwise decision. There's some things we can't compromise on, because while we may make it a ruling to bypass environmental laws, that very thing they're putting in the air could attribute to people respiratory problems. So we may be making it more flexible for the company to do their work because we're not enforcing the EPA laws. But at the same time, we could be making our people sick from respiratory issues. And oh, by the way, much of that monitoring is done by computers and machines. So I'm not sure why they did this. It's pretty stupid. It's done by air monitors. And people only get involved if they have an accident or incident where they have to send people out to check. But to tell companies you can put all the pollution you want in the air is just about as jackass idea I've ever heard of in my life. It's telling them release all the carbon you want, all the chloroprene you want, which they will do because these are foreign-owned companies. They don't give a damn about the health of the people in Louisiana. So I'm not quite sure why they did that, and I'll be doing some follow-up today with the state agencies, LDEQ, because they cannot give them a carte blanche. That means they can dump oil in the Mississippi River. That means they can let unlimited amount of chloroprene into the air. That will take us back to pre-Clean Air Act. So this is stupid as hell to tell them that we're not going to enforce the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. This is just damn stupid.
You know, yesterday afternoon, March 26th, I noticed you had a tweet, Twitter thread, and I'm just going to quote the start of it here. You directed it to the White House. In war, the enemy has a vote, and right now the enemy, COVID, is winning. Right now, we're losing battles in New York, Washington State, Louisiana, with other states in its sights to attack. Stop talking about winning the war. You must first start winning battles. Talk to me about what prompted that tweet, sir, and what you're seeing now in terms of federal policy right now in responding to this crisis.
Yeah, when you the way you end a war is to defeat the enemy. And right now, we're not defeating the enemy. This invisible enemy, as the words have been used from the White House podium. We're not winning. The enemy, in this case, the virus, is winning. So to start talking about conditions for winning is premature and stupid. We need to focus on winning battles. You win a war by winning battles. Right now, we have a battle in New York, Washington State, Los Angeles, and New Orleans, and many more states to come. Every day a new state is identified as being a hot spot. That being said, you might want to end the war, but the enemy has a vote. And in this case, it's the virus. And the virus is winning. The loser don't get to decide that. The winner get to decide the conditions of ending the war. And right now, the virus has that initiative, and it's attacking our people, destroying our integrity of our medical infrastructure, because when it go in, it's not just a sick person that it's affecting. It's affecting our healthcare workers, and it's affecting our first responders who respond to them and the families they left at home. So this is a very deep penetrating enemy, and we're not talking about ending this in weeks. We may be talking months or a year to get in front of this virus before we could talk about claim any cessation of operations. I don't think we will ever win until we have a vaccine that will treat people or a serum that will make them well. So we're way in front of the headlights on this one, talking about winning and telling people to get ready to go back to church on Easter Sunday. That's very aspirational, but right now it's stupid. We need to focus on providing as much medical supplies as we can, figure out how we mass our medical people in every state to provide the collective medical support we need to our people that are sick.
Logistics. You talk a lot about logistics in this threat.
Absolutely. You know, what it takes to solve a disaster in every case, whether it's this pandemic we're dealing with or flood, at the end of the day, it takes logistics. You got to have everything it takes to keep people alive, with emphasis in this case on medical supplies, PPE, and medication, and things that can keep people alive so their body can fight this virus. And right now, we're doing a very poor job of equitable distribution of the supplies we have, and then getting those supplies to the place they're needed. And for weeks now, I've been told the federal government to have positive control of all of that PPE in America that's coming in, that's on the ground, that's in warehouses, and the amount at every hospital is start talking about not numbers, but days of supply. Because some places we've got hospitals with 20 days of supplies, and some hospitals we've got 0 days of supply. And when you have that problem, you got to cross-level your supplies so everybody have an equitable amount to keep people alive. Your survival shouldn't be based on your area code. It should be based on the federal government using the Defense Authorization Act to cross-level those supplies so everybody have enough until the supply chain catch up.
Let me compare and contrast with you. Just doing a little research here this morning, looking back at Katrina, by, you know, the hurricane hits the coast on August 29th. By September 6, 2005, there were almost 60,000 U.S. service members aiding in rescue efforts, recovery efforts in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. You had about 41,000 of those service personnel were National Guard personnel. We're not there yet, quite, are we, sir?
Well, I think the governors have judiciously used the National Guard. I mean, in Louisiana, we have about 10,000.
Sure.
And the governor early on started to use the National Guard for the tasks that they could perform. And in the meantime, through requests through FEMA and approval of the White House, they have approved some hospitals coming into New Orleans. But you got to understand,
right?
Just as the steep curve of infection, we've been working on a steep curve of decision-making. And in a war, you plan, prepare, and you execute. We've had very little preparing time because for almost 2 months, our national government waved off the virus as a hoax. Matter of fact, some of our local political leaders said it was a hoax. Well, you know what? It's not a hoax. What that prevented the nation from doing is accelerating the production of some of the products we need today. Now, we can produce stuff, and we'll get the stuff fixed, the PPE, I think, in the next 10 to 12 days as the airplanes fly in with stocks from around the world and our own production over. What we will not do that we've got to fix is the shortage of medical personnel that are being exposed and becoming infected themselves. That is going to be what we call in the Army the long pole in the tent. How do we fill that gap by preventing our medical people from becoming exposed and becoming ill? And we're going to have some innovative ways to be able to test them periodically Because once a medical personnel become infected and they don't know it, they are infecting other coworkers as well as patients that might have come in for another ailment, and now they're getting infected. So we have to have a way to test our medical personnel, our EMS, and our police on and off shift to make sure they stay healthy. Testing is slow in Louisiana now, and we've got to get that picked up. And it's not the people of Louisiana, it's the availability of the tests.
Right.
Are we getting enough national media attention right now to what's going on here in Louisiana? And is it enough of the right sort of media attention, frankly?
Well, I don't know. I saw the mayor of New Orleans on yesterday. I saw the EMS chief, the Homeland Security chief of New Orleans on. Saw the governor on. Saw the Baton Rouge mayor on. Yeah, I think we're getting enough attention. Right now, we've got to continue to pound on the fact that we need more help in terms of hospital beds and ventilators. That's the message we got to send to the national government.
Any reaction to some of the national level criticism we're starting to hear this week of Mayor Cantrell for not cutting Carnival short?
Well, I heard her answer, and I think it's appropriate. We respond to threats based on information from Washington. You understand? Mm-hmm. And there were no threats coming that I recall, and as she recalled, nobody else can show that showed that we had the potential of the impact of this virus. Remember the White House was saying it was a hoax. Remember?
Right.
So this is a storm we get into when we try to mix politics with responding to a disaster. Now we're selecting who we send supplies to, or whether that person is complimentary of the commander in chief. What kind of bullshit is that? I've never heard of that before. So in order to get something from the White House, you have to compliment the White House publicly. That's the weird, that is some common issue there. As good as the government is, the government's going to need help. And the only one going to save us is us. We got to practice the social distance, stay home, take care of one another. Those that have the ability to volunteer, this is the time for them to step up and use their youth, their energy, to try to help people. And there are many organizations that's trying to help people who can't help themselves and still follow the social distance requirements. In the meantime, if you can't help, stay home. Call somebody. Try to engage with people you know that are shut in and make sure that they have what they need and attend to them socially and talk to people on the phone to make sure they're doing all right and to give them encouragement. I think we will eventually get past this, but it's going to get worse before we get better. And let's give praise to our medical people and our first responders who are answering the call, as well as those people who work in the hospital that don't necessarily have titles, but they keep that place clean, they keep it safe, and they keep the equipment running. Let's remember them.
We're thankful for them, and we're thankful for you, Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, U.S. Army retired, former commander of Joint Task Force Katrina, leader, Green Army. General, thank you, sir. We'll stay in touch. Lens reporters themselves continue to follow local developments with this crisis, especially local measures to bring the outbreak under control. Here are Chief Editor Charles Maldonado and Staff Writer Michael Isaac Stein. All right, Michael, you just updated some of your reporting online today as we record this by phone on Thursday evening. What's the latest with the convention center and its potential use in this crisis?
So on Wednesday, we had been reporting on the possibility that the state would tap the convention center to house certain patients recovering from the coronavirus. This afternoon at a press conference, Governor John Bel Edwards confirmed that that was the case. So the initial kind of phase here is going to be for 1,120 beds. So he said the first 120 beds should be set up by the end of the weekend, with the remaining beds coming in throughout the next week. And really, you know, this goes to a central challenge in Louisiana and around the world when it comes to this virus, which is hospital capacity. And the idea here is to, you know, once a patient is recovering from the virus, they don't necessarily need to have that same intensive care that you get in an ICU hospital bed. So once someone is stable, the idea is to move them over to other satellite sites, one of them being, you know, now the convention center, to kind of monitor them but not get that same intensive care. One thing to watch here is going to be how they actually staff this place. You know, like the governor said, you know, they could add more beds, more and more beds, but if you don't have the nurses and the doctors to actually treat patients, then they don't do much. So something to watch here is going to be, you know, where these healthcare providers actually come from, and how the state, you know, accounts for all that.
Charles, I'll ask you about some reporting by Sophie Kasikov about the homeless here in the city of New Orleans, removed from some of their usual encampments in the city.
Well, so this morning, the city and I believe the state as well did a sweep of several several homeless encampment sites in the city. Under the Claiborne overpass and over on Duncan Plaza in front of City Hall. You know, we see these sweeps often in New Orleans, except this one is a little different. These people were being taken to a temporary site to be held for a period during this crisis and possibly for the next 30 days. And it looks like they're being many of them are going to be taken to a hotel in the central business district so that they can be safe and isolated and neither catching nor spreading the disease. This is a deal that the state and the city have been working out throughout the week, and it's going to be at the first site that's been identified in a report by WWL on Wednesday. Was the Hilton Garden Inn in the central business district, which has about 155 rooms. It's unclear if the state and city are looking to add additional hotel sites to that to house homeless people, but at the same time, they have been going to other places for housing capacity for at least people who have tested positive. Including, as Michael talked about, the convention center and a couple state parks.
Our new criminal justice reporter, Nick Krastel, did some reporting this week on what's going on with the jails and some of the requests from the public defender's office here to release some of those inmates.
Yeah, that situation is evolving moment by moment. We had a big development in that today. In that Sheriff Marlon Gusman is now requesting that the judges make it possible for him to release all nonviolent inmates that do not have a criminal history, this has been, you know, Sheriff Gusman is you know, perhaps the most surprising figure to join in a series of calls to release as many people as possible from the New Orleans jail, you know, with the fear being that if an outbreak happens there, the situation could spiral out of control very quickly. It's difficult to socially distance in a jail setting, obviously, a lot of advocates have warned for several weeks now that if we start getting inmate infections in there, it could be a catastrophe. So we have heard from, you know, the public defenders have been talking about this for several weeks. They filed a petition with the criminal district court judges this week to release all high risk people who are older and people who, you know, maybe have underlying health problems. They had previously called to release all nonviolent offenders. As I said today, Sheriff Gusman has joined in calling for quite a large release. At the same time, as Nick reported earlier in the week, we are in fact seeing a reduction in the number of people coming into the jail because the police are arresting far fewer people. We had you know, record low, at least over the 10 years there, over the last 10 years, number of arrests in the week leading up to March 24th. The prison is at the lowest number, the lowest population count it's been in perhaps decades, or the jail, I should say, is at its lowest population count that it's been in possibly decades. I don't know if this comes from the pressure campaign. I don't know if it comes from fewer arrests taking place just because fewer people are out on the streets, but we are seeing fewer arrests in a very low jail population of just over 900 as of today.
Michael, you did some review of a new report published this week by the Data Center, a New Orleans-based research group, about some of our city's demographic vulnerabilities, if you will. What is the Data Center reporting this week?
Well, one of the big themes this week has been, you know, New Orleans trying to get the federal government and national media to recognize the severity of the spread here in New Orleans. And I think the Data Center was kind of adding to that with this report. And basically it was looking at certain demographic information and statistics about New Orleans that might suggest that the spread of the virus, as well as the mortality rate of the virus, might be worse than in some other places. So the report looked at New Orleans along with three other hotspots for corona spread. So that included King County in Washington, which includes Seattle, a combination of all five boroughs in Manhattan, and Westchester County, my hometown, actually. The main thing it looked at was household financial information. So if you look at income, for example, the median household income in New Orleans is much, much lower than in these other places. You also see a much higher percentage of the population paying 50% or more for their housing costs. And you see less people with savings that might be able to come in handy in a disaster like this. So all of this is to suggest, you know, that these factors are going to make the spread more likely. And so, you know, one example of how that works is if you have no savings, do you have the choice to stay inside and quarantine yourself instead of going to work? So that's just one small example. But I thought one interesting thing about the report is that it also, you know, went beyond just the rate of spread to the mortality rate. So it talks about the underlying health conditions that exist in New Orleans. You know, compared to the rest of the country, you see higher rates of hypertension and heart disease and higher rates of diabetes, for example. And now these things are obviously going to play a role when you actually come down with this virus. And that might, it was suggested in this report, increase the mortality rate of people who have this disease in New Orleans.
I leave you two men to get some rest for the evening. Charles, best to your family. Michael, best to yours. Michael Isaac Stein on the City Politics Beat and Chief Editor Charles Maldonado wrapping the weekend news. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Lens on live stream, on podcast, and on our community radio partners, 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans and 90.3 FM WAMF LP New Orleans.
I'm Karen Gadbois, founder and director at The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana. The business of journalism is important and crucial, and all our staff is working hard to bring you accurate and vital reporting. But we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit news. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website, thelensnola.org/donate. And remember, stay home, stay informed. We thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Lens. For the second half of the program, we want to focus on restaurants. To say it's a difficult time for them right now is, of course, an understatement. On the one hand, they're one of the few places that are still open, albeit for takeout service only. On the other, many have not made that transition. Many have had to lay off some workers. Some have had to close entirely. I spoke this week with Wendy Warren with the Louisiana Restaurant Association. First off, explain what the Louisiana Restaurant Association is and who you represent.
So the Louisiana Restaurant Association is an advocacy organization, and we represent restaurant owners and managers. We're a trade association, so we're not open to the public per se. So we really deal directly with restaurant owners and managers on a daily basis. And right now we're covered up with phone calls and emails from them trying to see clarity during the COVID-19 climate.
Granted, these numbers are changing daily. I understand that. But I want to get a sense of, in terms of data that you and your members are looking at, what can you tell me in terms of the impact on the restaurant industry in our state right now?
Well, right now, the National Restaurant Association did a survey of restaurants earlier this week, and we just got Louisiana-specific data about an hour ago. So I'm looking at responses tabulated that say 44% of operators in Louisiana have temporarily closed their restaurants, and 57% of operators temporarily changed their business model to off-premise only. So those are the people doing drive-through, delivery, and carry-out.
Right.
We're looking at 61% of the restaurant operators have laid off employees, and another 45% anticipate doing more of this in the next 30 days.
And we knew this was coming, but just to hear even the levels at this point, and you and I are talking on Thursday, the 26th, it's staggering. It's just wild to see what's happening as a result of this pandemic.
It is. It's, you know, we're often reminding ourselves that it's nationwide, but because food and cuisine and eating out is so ingrained in the fabric of Louisiana culture, it's very gripping right now for us to kind of have to talk to our members. And, you know, we can't really, you know, we don't really know what the future holds on a lot of these fronts, from COVID-2 bill to COVID-3 to what, you know, COVID-4, which is, you know, what we might have to fix to make this workable for us in the long run. So the federal legislation has a lot of things that our members are trying to work through, as well as their employees. What does this mean for everyone? And not just our industry, but across all industries. It's really, you know, we say it's those of us who went through 9/11, Katrina, the oil spill. Like, this is kind of uncharted territory in a combination of, you know, things that happened in all of those events, like all wrapped up into one right now.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out where to go next and what's the next steps for us as an association and our members as business owners and their employees. And, you know, it's just, it's just unfathomable right now.
You mentioned you were getting a lot of calls from your member restaurants, and I'm just curious, you know, what kind of, you know, if there are remarkable anecdotes that you're hearing now from some of your members and, you know, restaurant owners and staff.
Mm-hmm.
What are you hearing, you know, on ground level from this?
Just, you know, the uncertainty. How long is this going to last? I don't know. It's a virus. This is not a man making a decision. This is, you know, a bug passing from person to person. So we can't give any certainty as to when it might happen. We're talking a lot about SBA loans and how to apply for those, who to call for. We have transformed LRA.org, our website, into a COVID resource page that really has, we've gotten so much content on here. We've had to group them in business recovery resources, recovery advocacy. That's the things happening on the at the federal level. What COVID too was had some employee relief in there, but it also had some changes for employers that will take effect April 1st and go through the end of the year. So we have resources on what they need to do and decisions they need to make or make quickly in order to comply. We also have food safety and sanitation resources that are specific to the COVID climate. And one of the things that I think is particularly relevant in this is what the industry is doing for our employees during this time. So sure. I know that's one of the things you wanted to talk about. ServSafe is a suite of food safety and sanitation and alcohol training products. So one of the things the industry is doing right now is offering through the end of April free ServSafe COVID-specific training. So that ServSafe is, food safety, sanitation, there's alcohol training, there's sure. front of the house, back of the house, allergens training. So we really, as an industry, said, hey, look, our people are going to have some downtime right now. Let's offer them some free training so that when they come back to work, they have enhanced their skills. On the more specific and immediate need basis, we have partnered with the Greater New Orleans Foundation and Gail Benson, Dixie Beer, Crescent Crown, Tabasco are all supporting what we're calling the Service and Hospitality Family Assistance Program. And actually, the applications went live on Wednesday. So if you're hearing this on Friday, that was 2 days ago. And you can apply if you're in the 13 parish region of Greater New Orleans. And it's the information can be found on gnof.org /grants. And it has how to apply, who's eligible, and what kind of documentation that you need. So these are $1,000 grants that will be given to workers whose families are experiencing financial crisis right now.
It's gnof.org/grants.
Grants.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Got it. And one more time with your own website.
LRA.org. We also have employees for we have resources for restaurant employees. We also have information about the USBG Foundation Bartender Emergency Assistance. There's a Keep Calm Through COVID hotline. And there's also something that right now restaurant employees are considered essential, and restaurants that are open are considered essential, like a grocery store or a pharmacy, because many people rely on restaurants for their meals. So there's a draft letter that, in case you got stopped
sure.
by NOPD or whoever, you yeah. have a draft Papers, letter please. That your employer can sign saying, hey,
okay,
I'm going to and from work right now. So that's something that we saw in other states. We're also conferring with our other state restaurant association partners on what they're seeing in their areas so that we can kind of get ahead where we can on different issues that might arise.
Wendy Warren with the Louisiana Restaurant Association. Thank you so much. And Wendy, please stay in touch.
Will do. Thank you so much.
We wanted to talk to you with Jessie Musinski. She's a veteran New Orleans restaurant server. And on her downtime, she's built up quite a following on Twitter under the handle Sweet Babette.
I tell people all the time that Twitter is kind of like my congregation. I'm not really a church goer. But if I had a parish or a congregation, that would be what New Orleans Twitter fills for me.
As active as you are on social media, it's not your day job necessarily.
No.
Yeah. What do you do for a living?
So I am a restaurant industry worker, and I've been full time in the hospitality industry. Let's see, I got laid off from HR in 2009, and I worked in hospitality before that, and then have worked full time in hospitality in different aspects since then. And I am, I'd say, a fine dining waiter by trade. Though at the moment, I happen to be working at some place a little bit more casual, doing like a cash register and basic bartending setup. I've recently started at a restaurant bar called The Backyard. It's in Lakeview, 422 Harrison. It is a family neighborhood type of place where they have like playground equipment in the backyard area. Kids food special.
Sure.
You order at the cash register at the counter, get your drinks or beer, and, you know, a number, and then we bring the food out to you. So it's a little bit more casual than I've done. And honestly, it really landed me on my feet a little bit more than a lot of friends who are in fine dining right now. Uh-huh. Those restaurants haven't been able to switch lanes as quickly as the more casual places have.
Your place is doing, the backyard is doing takeout. I mean, you're staying busy at this point, correct?
We have some business. You know, I know some places are really killing it with their takeout.
Yeah.
We have some business. Obviously, it's nothing compared to what we would have on a normal basis, especially because, you know, part of our draw is to have your kids come there and run around together.
Sure.
But the Lakeview neighborhood is still taking pretty good care of us. And I'm really lucky to still have work 3 days a week, even if I'm making half of what I normally make.
But, I mean, it goes to say at least your establishment has been able to make that shift, at least for the time being. But you would say the business has fallen off a bit.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, people are staying home. That's good. I get that. We do takeout and we do Uber Eats delivery. And they're not only are the owners trying to do everything they can to keep their business open, because of course they are. Mm-hmm. They're really doing their staff a favor, and they're not taking any profit at this point.
What are you hearing from some of your sources that have not been so lucky?
People just don't know what to do. Like, obviously, this is a unique and extreme situation. But, you know, we're filing unemployment. And we being, like, the greater
hospitality industry, broadly speaking.
But unemployment in Louisiana is a bit of a joke. In case anybody out there doesn't know it, unemployment in Louisiana tops out at $247 a week.
It's pretty short change. It's not a lot.
It's better than nothing. But a friend in Boston is getting almost $600 a week.
Yeah, cost of living there being a lot higher. But the point being that our weekly unemployment support in Louisiana is awfully low.
And a lot of people have been reaching out to their car insurance company, their, you know, loans or things like that. And a lot of the different places are giving, 1 month to 3 month deferral on payments. So that's helping. So everybody's making those phone calls. There's a couple of different grants that are happening right now. The Barman's Fund is doing one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a couple. That's actually on my list of things to do for this evening, is to sit down and see which of those grant programs I might be applicable for.
Right.
Also, everybody's applying for food stamp benefits.
Talk to me about your concerns about healthcare coverage, both broadly and individually, if you like.
So most people I know in the service industry in New Orleans and wider across the country don't have health care. It's not something that restaurants typically offer unless you get into a larger corporate format.
Sure.
And even then, it's still only as good as right, anybody else's healthcare is in this country right now. So I definitely have encountered people who are not feeling well, who have some of the symptoms for COVID and are just staying at home and trying to see if it gets worse or not, because they don't have the money to go get the test. They don't have the money for the treatment afterwards. They're not making money right now. You know, everybody's trying to bare minimum hold on to the roof over their head. And so it's they're putting themselves at risk health-wise. A lot of us are working. I'm scared to be working. I'm doing right. it. And part of me is lucky that I get to a reason to go out of the house and be around other people 3 days a week, because I am a very social individual. But I also know that I've seen in the 5 days before we went to the current level of lockdown that we have now, I had to have come face to face with no less than 350 to 400 people because of the job I do. So, like, I'm worried at this point that I am an asymptomatic carrier.
Right.
I'm doing everything that I can to protect my customers, you know, washing my hands and wearing gloves and coughing into my shoulder if that happens and things like that.
Sure.
But I'm still, it was a big thing for me to realize that I was very upset because I felt like there was a chance that I was putting people at risk.
You know, and the general guidance is to act as if you already have the virus so that you can curb its potential spread. On the other hand, you get the messages from the governor and others, and certainly business leaders, et cetera, that we need restaurant workers to work if possible. I mean, it's a little bit of a dilemma, is what you were just talking about.
It is, and it's very interesting, and we're seeing this again across the country, that there are so many industries where the people make a low hourly wage, or as for us, like in Louisiana, still only requires the federal minimum wage for tipped employees, which is right. $2.13, which hasn't gone up in about 30 years.
Right.
So we're out here, like, quite literally, the least paid workers, but considered, you know, important enough to society for us to be able to you know, stay open and be providing the service now. So I do hope that something comes out of this with people kind of understanding society a little differently and maybe having a little bit more respect for every job. You know, I used to, my mother always used to say when I was a kid, oh my gosh, the world needs ditch diggers too. Which is, like, silly, right? But, like, everybody has a job, and everybody's job is important, and it, you know, should be seen and treated as such.
Right. There's one thing I have to know from you, and this is completely subjective. When I'm picking up a takeout order, what is the customary and reasonable tip for your server?
Are we talking customary and reasonable times or right now?
Let's deal with what we're dealing with right now. Or you could tell me both, certainly.
So normally, yeah. This is what I would say. Somebody has to prepare your food.
Yes.
Most places that you're going aren't paying, even at the higher paying jobs, a lot of times people are still only making $5 or $6 an hour and relying
sure.
on tips.
Sure.
So for takeout, I would usually say a couple of bucks up until 10%. Depends. Is it, you know, you walked in, you picked up a pizza, you know, you got $1.50, $2 on you, throw that down, that's fine.
Sure.
Did you just order lunch for your entire office and it's 15 different meals all packed up separately and stuff like that? You know, that should get you 10-15%.
Sure.
Because the person's putting more effort into it. But right now, like, if you are able to go out and purchase food for takeout from restaurants, you have to realize that the people who are there, like, are putting themselves at risk to be able to provide you this service. And
yeah.
Anybody that's coming in to me right now and it's not tipping 20%, I definitely am disappointed in that.
That's certainly fair to a Joe Blow consumer like me, you know, 20% for people who are, as you say, putting it on the line so that you can get fed a meal during our crisis.
In a full service situation, it's absolutely different. You know, when I work in fine dining, I have extensive food knowledge and wine knowledge, liquor knowledge. I can tell you,
you're going to work,
the recipes that we're cooking with and the history of the chef and stuff like that. You know, that is a little bit different than picking up a burger, from your corner place on a normal basis. But
delicious right now, though it may be.
Yes, very, very good. And I will say, I have been seeing some people who have been going above and beyond. I've had a couple, like four, I think, different situations where people came in for a $15, $20 order and tipped $100.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they can. One guy, I caught him, I said, oh my gosh, like, I can't thank you so much. And he said, like, I'm working from home right now. I'm actually still making all of my money. And I'm actually saving money at this point working from home, so the least I can do is spread it around some.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
good.
So those people are out there too.
Good. Jesse Mieszynski, better known to Twitter followers as Sweet Babette, and giving us a perspective on the hospitality industry here in New Orleans during these trying times. Jesse, thank you so much for taking some time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our thanks to Jesse, as well as Wendy Warren, Russell Honore, and the Lens own Charles Maldonado and Michael Isaac Stein for their help this week. And we remind you to monitor the Lens for the very latest developments on the COVID-19 crisis. There you'll find our community coronavirus guide and signups for email alerts, and learn how you can support our nonprofit news team today at thelensnola.org/donate. I'm Tom Wright with Behind the Lens. Stay home. Stay informed.